Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Finally today, we're going to spend some time with poet Richard Blanco. The Maine-based poet was the youngest, first Latino, first immigrant, and first openly gay person to serve as an inaugural poet. Here he is reading a portion of One Today at President Obama's second inauguration ceremony in 2013.
We head home through the gloss of rain or weight of snow or the plum blush of dusk, but always, always home, always under one sky, our sky, and always one moon, like a silent drum tapping on every rooftop and every window of one country, all of us facing the stars, hope, a new constellation, waiting for us to map it, waiting for us to name it together.
Richard Blanco is out with a new collection of poems, How to Love a Country. He'll be at the Charles River Museum of Industry and Innovation tonight, and he joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here, Kimberly.
Thanks for being here. First, Richard, listening back to that poem in 2013, what comes to your mind now?
Oh, just looking at the crowd and, like, just a sea of people. But also, you know, it's surprising. It was the first moment that I really had to I had a little over a month to write the poem. Three poems, actually, asked me to write. So it was the first time at the actual inauguration where I got to breathe, and I realized there's a little Cuban-American gay kid from a working-class family that's going to read a poem to the entire nation, and it's me. And it was it was the first time I realized this, how special that moment was. And so I was overcome by a sense of gratitude, but also what that moment represented for so many people like me who never weren't quite sure we were part of the American narrative in that moment. So I was honored in that moment as well to sort of thinking about all those little kids like me in this country and what that moment meant.
And your current collection is called, as I said, How to Love a Country. And the first poem in that collection is called Election Year. You write about tending a garden and the uncertain, the garden you cherish and the uncertainty around it. Will it survive in your care? Do you think that the United States will survive?
I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic that yes, as long as the institutions stay intact, as President Obama always says. Yes, that poem is sort of an allegory for the garden is our democracy and we are the gardeners. And it's also sort of also saying, you know, sometimes we do things right and the garden doesn't. There's a temporary lapse in the garden, and being from up here and being from Maine, sometimes those hostas just don't come up when you want them to come up, right? So I am hopeful that as long as we stand by the democracy and understand actually that we need to maybe participate in that democracy a little bit more, need to tend that garden a little more closely, that yes, I am optimistic that we will survive. And I think what's been happening in our political climate lately, in a way, you know, there's been, of course, things that I certainly don't agree with, but there's also been a lot of people that have just stepped up, you know, that have stepped up. And I found it beautiful because they're not stepping up just for things that matter to them personally, but that matter to us all. When the ban on Muslims was being put in place or whatnot, there were people just coming out of the woodworks, and it wasn't affecting them personally. I was saying, no, this is not who we are as a democracy. And I thought that was a good sign.
In the book, even before you get to the first poem, there's this opening that you call Declaration of Interdependence, where you blend lines from the Declaration of Independence interspersed with new lines. What were you trying to say here?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I didn't want the book to do is just be a one-beat kind of book. I didn't want to just preach to the choir. I wanted to do what poetry can do best, which is open up another dialogue, another conversation, and realize perhaps where we have all failed, right? And so, and also in that particular poem, I just wanted us to, you know, this polarization that we have has just permeated every single part of our lives, right? And so we can discount or object, sort of abstract and discount entire states, entire regions by what color they are on a presidential map. And we're not talking to each other. We feel like we've created this behemoth political class that we're not. We can only speak through through party lines. And I wanted that poem to sort of break up or make us think about that a little bit. And so to not make assumptions, to get rid of the stereotypes, to realize that there are good and bad people in every place, in every world, in every situation, to have more empathy for each other. And when I was reading the Declaration of Independence, I realized that we could almost send it word for word to Congress today. because we kind of like the same kinds of demands that we have been making seem to be keep on going nowhere. So there's some language in there that is just absolutely beautiful. But also the idea of interdependence versus dependence. And I think we need to move as a country from this idea of independence and me, I got mine, you get yours, to the idea that we're all interdependent. And I think, speaking to your first question, if we're going to survive, I think we need to also, as human beings individually, sort of come to that conclusion in our psyches.
And in your collection, you tackle a number of issues from politics to immigration, race in America, growing up gay, the Boston Marathon bombing, the wall, border security. I mean, how do you pull all this together?
Well, How to Love a Country is a statement. It's also a question. It's also a how-to book. It's an examination of everything that happens in a country and the complexities of all that. Throughout the last 5 years, I've also been doing commissioned or more occasional poems. As a result of the inauguration, I just started thinking about what is the role of a poem in our country? What is the role of the civic poet? What is the role of a more socially conscious kind of poetry? And so I just looked for opportunities where poetry could speak to that, including, like you were saying, the Pulse nightclub shootings, the Parkland High School shooting, but also moments of celebration, Freedom and Mary, and that's a love poem from my own partner who just a couple weeks ago asked me to marry him finally after 20-something years.
Congratulations.
So, I wanted to also celebrate what's going right. And so all this sort of mosaic of what makes up a country, it's a complex question, right? I mean, there's so many parts to it, large and small. And so there's still sort of some very autobiographical poems, too, that deal with my own sort of smaller, tighter focus on my relationship and with my country.
And I want to get to one of those poems. I would love if you would read it to us. Its title is El Americano in the Mirror.
Right. So just a few words about this. So I also wanted to implicate myself in the book and realize that in some ways we're all capable of fear out of ignorance, and we're all capable of sort of making odd and decisions and judgments about people. So I'll just say that. El Americano in the Mirror, for Derek. Maybe you don't remember, or don't want to, or maybe, like me, you've never been able to forget. May, 1979, fifth grade recess, I grabbed your collar, shoved you up against the wall behind the chapel, called you a sissy Americano to your face, then punched you, hard as I could. Maybe you still live as I do, with the awful crack of my knuckles slam on your jaw and the grim memory of your split lip. Why didn't you punch me back? That would have hurt less than the jab of your blue eyes dulled with pain. How you let your body wilt, lean into me, and we walked arm in arm to the boys' room, washed off the blood and dirt. Is that how you remember it? What you can't remember is what I thought when our gazes locked in the mirror, and I wanted to say, I'm sorry, maybe I love you, perhaps even kiss you. Did you feel it, too? At that instant, did we both somehow understand what I'm only now capable of putting into these words, that I didn't hate you, but envied you, the Americano sissy I wanted to be, with sheer skin, dainty freckles, the bold consonants of your English name, your perfectly starched shirts, pleated pants, that showy Happy Days lunchbox, your A-plus spelling quizzes that I barely passed. Why didn't you snitch on me? I don't remember now who told Sister Magdalene, but I'll never forget how she wrung my ears until I cried for you, dragged me to the back of the room, made me stand for the rest of the day, praying the rosary to think hard about my sins. And I did. And I have for 32 years, Derek. Whether you don't remember, don't want to, or never forgot, forgive me, though I may never forgive myself.
That's Richard Blanco reading El Americano in the Mirror from his new collection, How to Love a Country. Richard, have you heard from Derek, and do you know if he's forgiven you?
I've heard sort of, we were a very tight, sort of a small grade school class, so I know of him, and so I have yet to sort of present this poem to him. And that's always a scary thing, because it's interesting how memory, you know, in my mind it lives in some way, and that's kind of what the poem is taking up, you know. It was one of those childhood memories I just has haunted me all my life. And so I'm curious to hear his perspective, but I also I'm just wondering what that moment would be like. But I'm working on it.
And in many of your poems, including this one, you mention mirrors. Is there a function of a mirror? What does that serve in your work?
You know, it's interesting. That's come to my attention lately, and I think since so much of my work is about a quest for identity, belonging, home, place, I think this mirror starts becoming, the idea of a mirror starts becoming a motif, you know, how you're trying to find yourself, look for yourself. And yet in some ways a reflection is a reflection, but it's not your true self, right? It's a mirror image. And so I've been realizing that, yes, the mirror starts becoming a motif again, and thinking about how I see myself in others, how I see myself in this country, how I see myself in memory, how I see myself in all sorts of complex ways.
And I'd like for you to read another poem, sure, if that is okay. This one is titled titled Remembering Boston Strong. Of course, very important to our listeners here in Boston.
Yes, and that was, I believe, April 15th, right? If
yes.
I have that correct.
Yes.
Funny story about this poem. So I got to read this poem at the opening of the Boston Strong benefit concert, which was in a way a little more terrifying than the inauguration, because people were there to see Steven Tyler, not a poet, right? Bostonians, you know, we were all, everybody was sort of just celebrating the release. And so that was an interesting experience. Remembering Boston Strong. Years from now, you'll wish all you remember was how spring arrived just as you expected. The icicles gone as magically as they had appeared. The snow seeped back into the earth just as you had trusted it would. The thawed Charles and a river of runners ribboning that morning through the city that was a city long before our nation was a nation. While the ivy scribbled, climbed, turning green the red bricks your great-great-great-grandfathers laid. Memories. Mortar in every city wall and chimney. But years from now, you'll still remember this, the unexpected smoke that wasn't a spring fog, pink-purple blossoms mingled with the sparkle of shattered glass strewn over Boston Street, bursting red, red maples' tiny leaves opening like newborn hands to cup April's rain, the lives of two girls with names as pretty as Mayflowers, who would never bloom. The irony of the race ending with the mangled feet and legs of those wheeled away by those who did not run away. And the boy, the son, everyone's son, his life outlived by the budding tulips of window boxes, dressing up the city suddenly frozen in spring. Daylight each day a few minutes longer, but baseball diamonds dulled and muted. The sky each day a tint bluer, but stadiums abandoned, every seat an empty nest. The wind each day a hint warmer, but park benches cold and quiet, swings like pendulums stopped. Each night crickets louder in your ears, but winter still set in your eyes, caught in the glow of television sets, casting shadows of the news across living rooms and hollow city streets, locked down in silence. And years from now, what you'll mostly want to remember is not the shootout that ended the silence waiting, nor the bombers' names, nor the blasts, but the tender roses you laid across the finish line, the thankful praise you gave for the lives that saved lives in their arms, the brave promises of those who vowed to walk, dance, and run again. The stadiums and ballparks again filled with anthems sung by you, like 1,000 songbirds at once, a chorus into a second spring you had not expected. Dandelions still pushing through pavement cracks, spiders still spinning, forsythia still bursting yellow, elms still growing taller, and ivy still climbing the enduring walls of the city. Still a city, but a whole lot stronger.
Richard Blanco's new collection is How to Love a Country. He'll be at the Cambridge Forum event in Waltham tonight. There's more information about that on our website, radioboston.org. Richard Blanco, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.